Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, and Hilary Swank were big winners last night at the Oscars for their movie, Million Dollar Baby. But the new multi-billion dollar corporate face of Hollywood, says our guest tonight, is making it tougher for high-toned Oscar winners like Million Dollar Baby to make it out of the gates. Hollywood, he says, is now just one node on a corporate global media matrix, and fine drama is clearly not the point. When an emotional Jamie Foxx took home Best Actor Oscar Gold last night for his performance as the late Ray Charles in the film Ray, Foxx thanked many people, including director, writer, and producer Taylor Hackford, for having the patience to make the film.
Taylor, you took a chance, man. I mean, that love for Ray Charles was deep down in the earth somewhere, and you opened it up, and it's cracked open, and it's spilling, and everybody is drowning in this love. And I thank you for taking a chance on this film, and thank you for waiting 15 years to get me to do it.
A 15-year wait for a movie that has been lauded by critics because Hackford could not find financing for the film, a studio to produce it, Hollywood insiders who dared take a chance on a movie without chase scenes or extraterrestrials. Well, Jamie Foxx is now an Academy Award winner. Ray is a hit. But in the future, says our guest tonight, moviegoers may have to wait even longer for top-notch movies like Ray or Million Dollar Baby. Tonight on Point, the evolving movie business and how it shapes what we see at the Oscars and at the Cineplex. You can join the conversation. Have you seen Oscar winners Million Dollar Baby and The Aviator? Or were you at the movies watching Constantine or Son of the Mask? Is the era of great cinema drama over? Or is there always a new path to greatness? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Edward J. Epstein, author of the new book, The Big Picture, The New Logic of Money and Power in Hollywood. Edward Epstein, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
It's delightful to have you. It's a big look that you've got here at many corners of this huge business and how it's changed. But I was struck, Ed Epstein, at how you go way back in order to sort of bring the present into focus. You go all the way back to the origins of the Academy Awards and to the what I guess you see as the kind of high point of Hollywood, way back in the 40s. Why do you reach so far back to help us understand what we're looking at in Hollywood today?
Because the point of my book is to show that there are two Hollywoods, the old Hollywood and the new Hollywood. And the old Hollywood didn't evolve into the new Hollywood. It was replaced by the new Hollywood. The old Hollywood was based on movies. It derived 100% of its money from tickets sold at the box office and 99% of that at the American box office. The new Hollywood is about home entertainment, television, and the things you see on your television set like videos and DVDs and the games you play. And this transformation has so changed the logic that most people think there is no logic. William Goldman, the great screenwriter, famously said, "Nobody knows anything about Hollywood." And he's right up until a point. If you don't have the numbers, which fortunately I managed to get for my book, but if you don't have the numbers, it makes no sense. Once you have those numbers, Tom, the logic not only is there, but it is relentless.
So what's the relationship, Ed Epstein, between the new corporate structure of Hollywood, and we want to look at some of that history because it really is illuminating, but the relationship between the new corporate structure that surrounds Hollywood and the quality of pictures that we see?
Well, you know, the question of quality is a very subjective question because it's really not the quality, but the audience. If you make movies for children or teenagers, the quality could be very high, like in Pirates of the Caribbean or in Incredibles. You could have very good quality, but adults aren't going to be satisfied because it's not made for adults. Now, I can answer the question of why films are no longer made for adults.
Okay.
But the quality is really in the eye of the beholder.
I take your point. Incredibles, pretty good. Lots of adults liked it as well. But both of the movies you cite there, which did big box office, were aimed at children, not adults, not the kind of adult cinema drama that millions and millions of Americans turned out for in the 30s and 40s and 50s and beyond. Why not now?
Okay, let's look at it this way. In the years you mentioned, Tom, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, even the 20s and the 10s, the audience for the movies was the entire American adult population. In 1929, 95 million Americans went to the movie out of a population of 120 million. The children were sent to matinees on Saturday, and for the teenagers, they had what they called B pictures, which were Westerns and violent crime movies that came on as the second feature. So the first feature, the A film, the film that we're talking about, was designed for the adult population of America.
And 95 million attending, that's something like, you write, two-thirds of ambulatory America going to the movies, as I recall, every week.
That's right. It was a habitual audience. That audience no longer exists. It died with television, to make things very simple. And, you know, there were no television sets in the early 40s, and by the time television sets and color television sets penetrated American households, and 7/8 of American households had television sets by 1960. By this time, the people found it was easier and cheaper and more convenient to stay home and watch that little box than to go out. And when the VCR came in, there was even a better incentive. You can now watch whole movies on it. The result of all this is that they have to create an audience for each movie, each time they release a movie for an opening.
Because they don't have the tide automatically coming in, whatever they put it in the movie house.
Exactly, Tom. That's exactly right. Now, to create an audience, how do you do it? The answer is you have to advertise on television programs where you have herds of people watching that can suddenly be activated and can stampede that Friday to the movies.
To get that and first weekend big box office.
And, you know, adults are very diffuse. They're spread all over. They're listening to radio, hopefully your program. They're looking at their computers. They're reading books. But you have a large population of teenagers who cluster around a few programs. So they advertise on those programs. They advertise with focus groups. They design the ads to activate that audience. They design the movies to go with the ads. And so basically you get those kind of action movies.
And you point out that these days the cinemas themselves, the movie houses, don't really even make their profit from the movies. They make it from selling popcorn and all the rest at the refreshment stand, another place that teenagers flock to. They make their money on popcorn-eating teens.
Right. There's a happy coincidence there, that the very audience that they're able to lasso and stampede to the theaters also likes to feed themselves on popcorn, which give the theaters profits. They also like to play games, which is a very new profitable area for the movie companies. And so basically, there's been a huge shift in what is the logic of making movies. If you want to make money, and in the book I give the Midas formula, you go after this audience because it's just too expensive to find the audience for Sideways. There is an audience for Sideways. Now, if we go back, you know, to the 1930s, it would be the entire American population would want to see a movie like Sideways. And maybe they still do, by the way. But you cannot get them to go on a specific weekend because these films open for one weekend, and if they don't do well that weekend, they're dead. How do you find an audience like that? Word of mouth will eventually produce the audience, maybe, but they need the audience then and there. It's a little like an election where you need the voters to go on election day, and election day is the opening.
So you need them to flood in. They come in for the big action pictures with lots of special effects. And then on top of that, we've all seen it, the merchandising, the T-shirts and the action figures and toys and DVDs and video games. So with all of that, Ed Epstein, when you watched, and I'm sure you did watch the Oscars last night, what's the drama that you see unfolding there, and what's it called, the Kodak Theater? What are we witnessing when we watch the Oscars?
Well, I could tell you what I see. I see the merger of television and movies into an entertainment economy. I see the ABC program. Remember, ABC is owned by Disney. In fact, all six broadcast networks are owned by the companies that own the movie studios. Mm-hmm. So I see this fusion. I see the Academy Awards as a too long, informational, going on for 3 or 4 hours with the red carpet, in which everything is either a product placement or an ad.
And the kind of films that we see celebrated there, you describe them as a kind of antique, a kind of remnant of the prideful age of Hollywood decades back now.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing the films displayed there. I think Clint Eastwood is a terrific director. I love everything he does. And I think I'm so happy he won the award. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say is that what I saw there, I wasn't looking at the individual films. I saw these as opportunities to put on television ads for themselves, to celebrate themselves, to create a myth of Hollywood as a huge product placement, interspersed with regular commercial ads for automobiles and things like that. Now, that's what I was looking at. As far as the individual movies go, that's even, I think, more interesting and maybe perverse. Because what they celebrate is what they don't do. They celebrate movies like Million Dollar Baby or Sideways or Aviator, which break all the rules, the Midas rules of making money.
Way outside, so, what's the mainstream today? We're going to look at that, exactly how that dynamic works with Edward J. Epstein tonight. His new book is The Big Picture, The New Logic of Money and Power in Hollywood. Mr. Epstein, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We are talking about the evolving movie business and how it shapes what we see at the Oscars and at the Cineplex. You can join this conversation tonight. Did the Academy Awards last night celebrate your year in movie viewing, or were you off to see Alien versus Predator and Saw? Are the movies giving you what you want and need? And if most moviegoers are giving a complete pass to Oscar-nominated films, how long can that tier of films last? We're 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight, the day after the Oscars, about the evolving movie business and how it shapes what we see. My guest tonight is Edward J. Epstein. His new book is The Big Picture, The New Logic of Money and Power in Hollywood. We'd really like you to join our conversation as well. Are the movies giving you what you want and need? What did you see on display at the Oscars last night? What do you see when you go down to the neighborhood Cineplex? And does Hollywood still move you, challenge you, transport you? Or is that history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. It's been said that the films nominated for Oscars, and Ed Epstein is saying it tonight, are not the movies that most people go to see, that Hollywood's elite films are disconnected from much of the popular culture. Last night, Oscar host Chris Rock tested that theory. He took his microphone and camera out to the Magic Johnson Theater in L.A.
What was your favorite movie this year?
Alien versus Predator.
Alien versus Predator. Now, what was your favorite movie last year?
Probably Saw.
Saw. What was your favorite movie this year?
I guess Chronicles of Riddick. It's pretty good.
Chronicles of Riddick.
Yeah.
Did you see Sideways?
No.
No, I didn't.
No, I didn't.
Did you see Finding Neverland?
No.
No.
Did you see Finding Neverland?
No.
Did you see Million Dollar Baby?
Didn't see that.
No, I didn't.
Chris Rock with his microphone out in L.A., and he had the audience inside the Academy Awards wincing last night. Those people did not go to see the films that were nominated. I'm joined tonight by Edward Epstein. He's author of the new book, The Big Picture. We're also joined right now from Middlebury, Connecticut, by Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department and curator of the Film Archive at Wesleyan University. Janine, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. I'm always happy to be on your show.
It's terrific to have you. I wish you'd jump in here with us. As you watched last night and you saw the parade of movies there, Ed Epstein is saying, you know what? This is way outside the mainstream. You heard it there just now in Chris Rock's interviews. Was it ever thus, or do we have a narrower and narrower band of films that are likely to be anywhere on the Oscar-nominated list now? Is it really something outside the movie mainstream today?
Well, there's a couple of things about it. I mean, first of all, the Oscars are not necessarily designed to reflect mainstream taste. They're guild to guild, they're actor to actor. You know, they're people voting for their crafts inside. So whether anyone liked them or not is not necessarily the goal. But in the old days, of course, as Ed's wonderful book, by the way, it clearly makes the point, is that, you know, movies were aimed at the mass market in a way that they aren't quite. So, of course, everybody went to Casablanca. Everybody went to Lord of the Rings, too, last year. Everybody went to Titanic. But everybody hasn't been to the movies that happen to have been nominated this year, because a lot of them opened small, and they didn't open wide, and they didn't play everywhere. And I thought Chris Rock's point was hilarious, yeah. But you know, the thing is, if you went to the movie theater here in my town, the answer would be, yeah, I saw it. Everybody saw it, because you got college kids and you have a college community, and we all saw the picture. So what do you know then? But these clearly are not going to be the blockbuster hits. Movies are targeted now for smaller, more specific and selected audiences, because there's so much else for people to do with their time visually. To, you know, there's TV, there's the internet, there's, God help us, reading. I guess they're always
we remember that.
But it's different, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, Ed's book, excuse me for calling him Ed when I haven't met him, but his book does, I think, really point out to us how times have changed. I don't think it's so much that Hollywood doesn't meet us as an audience anymore, but it's just that the business is operating differently than it did in the golden era of the studio system. The studio system is dead.
And he makes that case powerfully. He paints a picture of, of course, not everything was great then either, but as you say, you had mass audiences coming out for Casablanca. We've had big audiences more recently for Oscar winners as well. But do you see, in the current corporate structure, well, Hollywood is just one little node on this giant, gangly, global corporate media network, does that work against overall quality in films? Or has the film-watching public been, I don't know, debased? You know, do they just want chase scenes now? How do you see the balance of corporate structure affecting film and public taste demanding what they get?
Well, there was always a corporate structure, remember. It was just smaller, perhaps more focused. But I think that one of the things that you can never get around is it costs a heck of a lot of money to make any movie. And then you have to have a distribution and exhibition system that takes another risk on it. So when you're putting that kind of money in, you want it to be a success so you get your money back. And any time money is dictating artistic decisions, they're going to be less artistic than they might be and more business-oriented. I think that what I look at is the positives. The independent movement has brought us a lot of small movies about new kinds of people, new ways of living, new life choices, mm-hmm. new subjects and topics that we never saw at our neighborhood Cineplex before,
right,
or for the 20 years. I think you still have great artists working. We saw two real masters at the top of their game this year, Marty and Clint. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they made great films. We saw fresh things we didn't expect. Hotel Rwanda. Who knew that was going to be a deeply moving movie? So, and you have the Sundance Institute and all it does. You always have the possibility of good material as long as the audience supports it. But you have to remember that there's a lot of competition for the viewer.
Well, we all know that. Ed Epstein, let me put it to you. I'm still not sure, reading your book, and it's a wonderful book, but I'm not sure if I'm, you know, supposed to be worried about this change in corporate structure of the movie business. As Janine points out, there's still a lot of excellent films that get made. So does it matter if it's now part of this globe-straddling uber empire of media, or are there always going to be great films that come out from, you know, small shops, medium and large shops, and, you know, we'll get the good stuff even if the big mainstream is shoot 'em up action?
Tom, I think it's the wrong question if you ask about the corporate structure or the movie business. It's no longer a movie business. It's an entertainment economy. They're still going after the audience. The audience is 300 million people. On any given night, average night, 4.5 million people are going to the movies, and 260 million people are watching television.
Right.
They're going after that 260 million people. They're delivering on MTV, the Disney Channel, ESPN. Those are all owned by the companies that own the Hollywood studios.
But I guess I asked the question, Ed Epstein, because as a movie buff, I still care about the movies, distinct from TV and video games. I care about them. A lot of people do. So when you tell me that the structure is changing radically, I want to know, what's it mean for the future? Does it mean good films keep coming, or are they going to be swamped?
I don't know what you consider a good film. You're going to get basically what the six studios in Hollywood are going to produce are the movies that they can make money on. That's what they're going to produce.
Well,
whether they're good movies or not, or whether you have independent filmmakers, which you're always going to have,
mm-hmm.
and you maybe have more than ever, but are they going to get distributed, and are you going to find them? And are people that aren't in large cities or college campuses, are they going to see the films? I don't know. And this is not, you know, to my mind, the real issue is not so much the logic of the independent film movement. If people can get money, they'll make movies all the time. If they can get money from their family or friends, or there will always be independent movies. There will always be documentaries. Mm. If you look at the things that awards were given for, 2/3 of them last night weren't made by Hollywood studios.
There's, right.
You know,
a lot of
the
independent
Sundance
work.
Institute.
Right.
That's going to go on forever.
A lot of independent work there. So, Janine, how about from your angle? Do you care that it's become this global corporate structure? Does it matter?
Like, I'm a real movie nut, so I'll go to the big, ugly junk. I'll go to the little good stuff. I'll go to every. I see every movie practically every year. Yeah, listen, I saw Saw.
Oh.
I see everything.
I missed that one.
I see everything, and that's what I do. I like movies. I have easier access to movies now than I ever did in my life. And by the way, I grew up in a town called Brookings, South Dakota, and I saw every movie released by Hollywood because they all played our town when I was growing up. When I was back there in the summer, they were playing documentaries, independent films, and big Hollywood blockbusters in a movie complex there, and everybody in town was going to all of them. So I'm not quite sure. It seems to me I have easy access to more choices now than I ever did before.
Because there are more outlets, more ways to see what's being produced.
There are more venues for the movie to reach me, including Netflix.
So you're saying bring on the global media giants. Who cares? There's always going to be creativity poking through, and you'll get to see it these days.
I'm not quite saying that, but what I'm saying is there has always been junk. There have always been bad movies. Hollywood in the golden era made a lot of bad movies and a lot of junk, and it will ever be thus because there's an appetite for junk. As long as there's an appetite for something good, they'll also make something good, and I don't see a Mabusian kind of sinister thing at work here. I'm sensitive to the idea that that it could go bad if fewer and fewer people control, you know, what we're seeing and what we're getting. But it seems to me that more and more people are getting involved in making it from different points of view, and thus we do have more choices. This year is a case in point. We saw some really good movies this year.
Yeah, we saw them on display last night. So here's the message, how we learn to love the global media empire and, roll back and enjoy it. Let's get our callers in here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mikey's calling from Boston. Hi, Mikey. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. It's a great show. I really appreciate it. I'm a young filmmaker or aspiring filmmaker.
Great. You go, man. You go. What kind of films are you making? Documentary or drama?
Well, I went to school where, you know, mostly we were making documentaries, but I'm interested more in fiction myself. So, you know, I take what work I can get.
Okay.
But I kind of take issue with this from the perspective of a young person trying to crack into the industry, because I very much would like to make films like Million Dollar Baby, like The Aviator, character films.
Sure.
I'm a great fan of, you know, the golden era of Hollywood and movies that harken back to those days. And I'm just wondering where the place is for people like me, young people who in 30 or 40 years would still like to be making films. And making films like Million Dollar Baby.
Sure.
Where do we fit into this equation of this global marketplace that is maybe going to flush out what we laughingly refer to as art?
Right. Mikey, we got it. Let us pick it up. Ed Epstein, in 30, 40 years, maybe sooner, Mikey wants to be waving that golden Oscar above his head on the stage in L.A. Where does a young filmmaker with that kind of ambition plug in?
If he wants to make The Aviator, he's going to need
a lot of money.
$100 million. He's going to have to break every rule. These aren't cheap movies. They only look like
they don't look
artistic.
Cheap either.
Well,
they're not cheap.
Correct. He just defined his goal as being an industry goal. So on that basis, there's not much Ed and I can say other than, these cost a lot of money.
We know they cost money. Okay, Ed, let's hear it.
I'm going to say that if he made a movie as long as The Aviator, it would be not played in multiplexes because they would lose a showing a night.
Right, just
unless
a little too
long.
Unless
he was Martin Scorsese, mm-hmm. and even he can't get it played. The Aviator breaks every rule. If you're going to make a movie and the movie is going to get greenlighted, there's going to have to be a movie of that dimension, not a movie that costs $200,000 or $300,000 or $600,000. There's going to have to be a marketing plan. And that marketing plan is they're going to have to say, how can we recruit an audience to go to the movies that week? The reason that Harvey Weinstein and the reason that Miramax is basically collapsing at Disney and is now its biggest money loser is basically because he wanted to make artistic films. And I applaud him for making artistic films, but his contract ends in about 6 months.
But you and Janine are just, you don't seem to have a problem. Here goes Miramax, which made some of the most interesting films. You say it's collapsing. Mikey wants to be making that kind of film in a few years down the road. How's he going to do it?
Well, one of the things that my students have done when they've left school, they've gone, I mean, now that for the first time, really, a film artist can afford his or her own tools, and I agree with that, you know, you still have the problem of the distribution system and exhibition and all of that. I don't want to oversimplify this. But for the first time, people without a lot of money can at least shoot and make independent features and then try to sell them. And the big corporate studio quotes that we have, you know, Fox, Searchlight, they have Paramount Classics, they have...
So you're saying pick up your cheap camera and get filming?
Well, my students have managed to do projects like this, keeping them small, keeping them cheap, selling them at Sundance or on the independent market, and moving up the food chain accordingly. I'm not saying this is easy, and I'm not saying it's in refuting Ed's point, which I'm very much aware of. I think it does mean that for the first time, young filmmakers like our caller have a better chance than they ever did before. And that started breaking through a while back with, you know, as far back as El Mariachi. I mean, we have begun to see new voices for that reason. There's a better outlet. When a film like Napoleon Dynamite, you know, gets out there, makes its money back, you know, it creates appetites that are new also. The public will go, and they will see things if it can get out there. And ironically, the ugly corporate giant will buy those little things and sell them because they are greedy. They'll want to sell anything they can get money for.
So work the giant. Work the giant.
Well, you know, work up the ladder to the giant if the giant is where you want to go. Stay away from the giant if you don't want the giant to eat you would be, you know, my warning to individual my students after they get to a certain level face that dilemma. Miguel Arteta, who made Star Maps and The Good Girl and Chuck and Buck, now has to decide, does he go make a Queen Latifah movie or what? I mean, you know, because, you know, Ed's point is, like, you are working up toward the giant. If you don't look out, you have to stop and think what you're doing.
And if you're lucky, you end up in Scorsese's position, but precious few do, Ed Epstein.
I just want to mention that even if the studios got films free, and they often do at Sundance, even if they got them free, they might not distribute them, or probably wouldn't, because they have to spend $30 or $40 million to recruit that audience. And if they can't recruit that audience with $20 or $30 million, it doesn't matter that someone gives them the film. The problem really isn't making the movie. I agree that you can make movies very inexpensively with your video camera. And the problem isn't showing them at film festivals. The problem is that you have to find the time that people are watching television,
getting it out to that big audience. Ed Epstein, Janine Basinger, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about the evolving movie business and how it shapes what we see. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the evolution of the movie business and how it shapes what we see at the Oscars and at the Cineplex. Famed director Sidney Lumet was given a Lifetime Achievement Award at last night's Academy Awards. The maker of films like Dog Day Afternoon and 12 Angry Men thanked some of the great directors who came before him, Wilder, Kurosawa, Kazan. But above that, he thanked the movies themselves and the industry that brought magic to the big screen.
I'm not mentioning the ones that I really stole from. What about the Epsteins for writing a line like, "Here's looking at you, kid"? Or Wilder and Diamond for, "Well, nobody's perfect"? Or Farrago for, "Mother of God, is this the end of Rico?" So what I guess it comes down to is I'd like to thank the movies. I know that sounds general, but it's very real to me. I've got the best job in the best profession in the world. So I just want to thank all of it.
Director Sidney Lumet feeling pretty good last night. You can join our conversation tonight. Are the movies giving you what you want and need today? And when cinemas make their money not on film, but on popcorn, what kind of movies do you expect? And then here comes technology. What do you think? As movies go digital, will a generation of video game buffs take the reins from old-style dramatists or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight by Edward J. Epstein, author of the new book, The Big Picture, The New Logic of Money and Power in Hollywood. He joins us from New York. And from Middlebury, Connecticut, by Janine Basinger. She's chair of the Film Studies Department and curator of the Film Archive at Wesleyan University. Right now, Wesley is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, Wesley. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for my call. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you, Wesley.
Hey, last night I saw Bad Education, which will probably be in my top 10 lifetime best movies.
This is Pedro Almodovar's Spanish film from last year?
Right, right. It took a while to get to Greensboro, but it got here, and I suspect it made money. I suspect the station agent made money. I also suspect that, I know that the wedding banquet made money and also made reputations for Ang Lee.
Right.
And I think there's money in good films.
Yes.
So it looks like good times to you, not like homogenization, but like some really
very
interesting
much
stuff
I
coming
through. I remember Alvin Toffler, reading Alvin Toffler, Future Shock.
Yep.
He predicted we would all be eating at Howard Johnson's and and staying in the same hotel wherever we lived.
Right.
We can do that, but we also have vast choices.
So
I think it's getting better.
So things coming up roses here, Janine.
Yeah. Well, we do have more choices and more different kinds of choices than we ever had, or than we had for a lot of time. There was a period there where it got kind of crunky, but the thing is, we do have choices. I would never have had access to Napoleon Dynamite. I wish I hadn't had access to Garden State. I happen not to like it. My students love it, so we're still beating up on each other about
right.
that. But we do have a lot of options, including when my daughter was little, my husband and I had to go out one at a time. Now all the married couples get Netflix and see everything at home.
Sure.
And there's streaming movies on the internet, and there's a wider level Because, yeah, they do have to advertise them. They do have to put the money, but they're out there. There's more variety. We're hearing more different voices, seeing more different worlds and attitudes than before. And the corporate giants are smart enough to buy those little things for peanuts and sell them to make some more money. I don't see the Miramax going from Disney isn't going to stop good work from being done. Warner Brothers turning down, being not wanting to do Clint's movie, didn't stop Clint from doing it. So
there are ways to go if you just keep at it. Ed Epstein, you paint an interesting picture of where some of this may be headed, riding on technology. As you point out, movies have always been affected by technology, whether within the industry or by surrounding technology, television and the rest. But you're particularly compelling in some of the last pages in your book on what happens as movies go digital. And there's two sides to that, at the cinema, but also in production. I wish you'd give us each of those. First of all, are we going to have digital cinemas all over the country? As you point out, a lot of things are made digitally now and still converted to those huge rolls of film. That seems pretty old-fashioned. When does that go by the boards?
Well, I just want to say one thing, that it might look like movies make money, but if you look at the actual statements of the movies, which I have in my book, the actual costs of just translating subtitles, none of these movies make money for any of the studios. The studios lose on every studio loses on what they call current production, theatrical release. All their films together, they lose money. They make it up in the later aftermarkets, which are television mainly and DVDs. I have all these numbers, and you have to look at them rather than just assume that because you saw a movie and there were some other people in the theater, it made money. The costs of actually getting a movie in the theaters are more than the cost, than the receipts from the tickets.
We've got it. And you point out hundreds of millions of dollars, and still they can lose money, but they eventually make it. It's not very profitable.
It has nothing to do with popcorn. I want to say that, too.
The cinemas, you point out, make money on popcorn.
The movie theaters make money, but not the studios. They get nothing out of it.
No, of course. But ultimately, with all of the other extra venues, a film can become profitable,
sure,
which is why they put it in the theater. That's the first outlet of it. I would like to, you know, the history of the film business is a history of shifting technology and of the business being like a vampire that can never be killed. No one can find the stake. They went from the Nickelodeon to the screen. They survived sound. They survived, you know, the problems of the Depression. They survived television. They're surviving, you know, the Internet.
Well, they lost 90% of their audience. There used to be an audience that went to the movies of 100 million people a week, and now 28 million.
But that doesn't mean people aren't watching movies. They're watching them in another venue.
Lots of different
ways. They're watching them on television.
I want to come back to this point of technology, Ed, because it's a pretty interesting one. You describe how increasingly things are digitized in Gladiator. I didn't know this, but that the image of Russell Crowe's face was scanned into a computer and then masked on to stunt people who did most of the stuff in the arena. Now you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger and others who've had full body scans and very complex kind of insertions of digital images, even of the person themselves hanging on that crane. They're not really hanging on the crane. You describe a kind of transfer here where the old dramatists may give way to the kind of, you know, computer geek world in terms of being the main drivers, as I read you, of film. Do you see that coming?
Well, trying to go back to this point that Janine makes very well, that we do have a culture and a community that produces movies. The digitalization basically alienates that culture because a movie is now made in two places. Mm-hmm. Part of the movie is made on a set, and there you have people who really care about the art of the movie. Mikey, who's going to be there with his camera, and the students of Janine. That's on one side. The rest of the movie is outsourced to digital houses that work over maybe a period of a year or two, making the scenes that actually fit in. So you have half of Arnold Schwarzenegger's head in the Terminator 3 is actually Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the other half of the head is the robot side of it is done in a computer factory somewhere.
And off we go, the human factor's sharing with the tech factor very much front and center there. Lee's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Lee. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, Lee. What's on your mind?
Well, as an independent filmmaker and a teacher of digital filmmaking, I've long since felt that it's going to be really hard-pressed at this level to impress upon Hollywood anything about stunts or CGI or special effects, but I think the independent film market does have a finger on the pulse of heart and soul.
You mean you can't beat Hollywood on special effects? They're so expensive and sophisticated, but the indies, as you say, bring heart and soul.
Yeah, and last night kind of proved that I think Hollywood hasn't forgotten that, because I've seen Million Dollar Baby twice, and it is so full of heart and soul, it makes you want to cry. And it's right there on the screen. And I don't care if there was CGI involved. I really, really felt that in my heart, you know?
And
independent filmmakers have to do that because their life depends on it.
And they'll keep bringing
They don't have budgets and investors.
And all of Pixar behind them. Lee, we've got it. Janine, what's your sense of where technology is going to take dramatic cinema?
Well, technology will not go away, and, you know, Ed has, you know, raised one of the horrors of technology, is that it takes things out of the hands of the artists, and, you know, it is, but I guess I'm an optimistic type. I mean, there's nothing to say that digitizing and taking those things over to outsources doesn't mean that the outsourcing people won't want to be artists or aren't artists too. And I like the point made by the filmmaker from Raleigh, which is the heart and soul remains. The main thing is always the storytelling process. We want stories, and we like stories told to us in images, and we'll go for them. We'll go out to see them. We'll stay home to see them. We'll look at them on the computer. We'll make them on our own little Pixar things. We'll take them if they're digitized. We'll take them if they're on film. We'll take them if they're outsourced. Tell us.
Sounds like green eggs and ham, Janine.
Well, make us cry like Million Dollar Baby. I mean, tell us a good story. We'll go for it. And you know, if they don't do that, if it does become cold and soulless and repetitive and corporate and bad, we're not going. They're not going to get my dollar.
Sounds like you are still putting your faith in the triumph of the creative there. Janine Basinger, always great to have you. And
thanks. Thank
you for being with us tonight.
and thanks to meeting Ed by phone. I like your book, Ed.
Good to get
Thank
you together.
Thank you very much, Janine. And I enjoyed every and agreed with everything you said.
Janine Basinger. Chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University, and Edward J. Epstein, wonderful to have you tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Ed Epstein, Edward J. Epstein, author of the new book, The Big Picture, The New Logic of Money and Power in Hollywood. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Lebanon's pro-Syrian government resigns. This is On Point. Lebanon's Prime Minister Omar Karami resigned today with his pro-Syrian government as more than 25,000 flag-waving Lebanese protesters marched outside of parliament in Beirut 2 weeks after the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. A caretaker government will be assigned to lead the country until parliamentary elections planned for this May. Public opposition to Syria's longtime occupation of Lebanon has surged since Hariri's assassination. Joining me now from East Lansing, Michigan, to talk about the day's developments is Rami Khoury, executive editor of Lebanon's The Daily Star newspaper. Rami Khoury, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We don't often catch you in the States. I'm sure your head was turned by the news out of Beirut today. How do you interpret what's happened there? Is this democracy on the march? Is this George Bush's wave of democracy in the making?
Well, those are two different things that you mentioned. And
yes.
My response is that it is the latter rather than the first, the former rather than the latter. I think this is a function of indigenous push for democracy and reform and modernity and better governance. It is not really related to what George Bush is doing. Now, there may be a situation where what George Bush says he wants to do, which is push freedom and democracy in the region, That external pressure, combined with what the Europeans have been doing, may combine with indigenous drives for reform and development to reach the same goal. But I think it would be a big mistake to fall for the spin doctrine coming out of the White House and the cheerleading that this is the consequence of what George Bush has done in Iraq and in other places. But I think we need to be careful not to get into an argument about, is this the American pressure, or is this the consequence of Iraq spreading democracy, or is this the Arabs themselves?
Sure.
We want to reach the goal, which is to have democratic governments.
So we won't automatically conflate those two. Point taken, two streams running here. But then the question here is there a scenario, is it even imminent, where Syria pulls out of Lebanon? Do you see that coming, or will any government continue to have to accommodate Syria and Syria's troops inside Lebanon?
Oh, no, I think it is imminent. And the Syrians themselves for some years, have said that they're going to be getting out of Lebanon when the time is right and when the Lebanese government asks them to and when security is restored and when Israel is not a threat in South Lebanon and all these things. Now, that time is obviously going to be getting closer now because of the clear demand of the Lebanese people that the Syrians pull out and the international pressure on Syria. The combination of those two things is really pretty irresistible. And the Syrians themselves will not be able to overcome it. So I think you will see the Syrians pulling out soon.
What's the impact for the region if Syria pulls out of Lebanon? What's the knock-on effect?
I think it depends on how it's done and what kind of credibility the Syrian government maintains. If it's done in a way that makes the Syrians look weak and vulnerable, you might get further pressures on them externally and internally. If it's done in a coherent and reasonable way, then I think it might set the stage possibly for a resumption of the Arab-Israeli peace process. So you get the Syrians and the Lebanese and the Palestinians and the Israelis wrapping up a peace agreement. That's not going to be easy to do. There's a lot of obstacles. But the momentum is going to push in that direction, and hopefully you'll also get reform issues moving quickly within Syria and within Lebanon.
What about that within Syria? Does pulling out encourage reformers? Are there reformers there? Is there a wave that comes out of little Lebanon and eventually hits Damascus?
Well, I think yes. I think that's the sort of direction. And you have Syrians who have been pushing for reform clearly, and even the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, would say that he has been leading the reform process, and at one level he has in terms of some of the economic reforms. But political reform is the big issue, the rule of law, equality, justice, etc., and civilian control of the military forces. And these will take longer to happen. But I think the pressure is inexorable and inevitable. It's already there, and the combination of domestic pressure and external pressure is going to continue, I think. And if it's done carefully, this can be a win-win situation that everybody, the Arabs can benefit, the Israelis, the Americans, the Europeans, everybody can benefit if we can do this working together. And this is a slim chance, but we have to hope for it.
Rami Karu, just 20 seconds here. Give us an emotional reaction or what you imagine that the emotional temperature in Beirut is tonight with this resignation after big protests.
Well, I know the temperature is very high. I mean, I was there just 5 days ago when people were in the street. And this is really powerful stuff. This is people standing up, crossing a threshold of fear, demanding from their own governments that people live in liberty and democracy and equality. So it's very powerful stuff, and you see it a little bit in Egypt, you've seen it in Palestine, and it's a movement that's been going on for some years but is now getting stronger.
Well, it's turning our heads. Rami Karu, always great talking with you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Rami Karu, executive editor of Beirut's The Daily Star. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.